Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
We have launched Rockonteurs Extra, and you can sign up now.
For extra bonus episodes, such as our little special on Andy Rourke and David Crosby.
Yeah, whoever, you know, any chat that Guy and I feel like having with each other, which doesn't go on the regular programme.
You're invited.
You are, and there's some exclusive video clips, apparently.
From the likes of Stuart Copeland, Paul Simonon, and our recent live show at, where was it, Gary?
I think I've been there before. Yes, the screen on the green. And you can only see those if you're a Rockonteurs subscriber.
Plus exclusive listener Q&As.
Yes, so you can ask us all about our history. You can ask me if I've ever been to the screen on the green or if I've ever seen the Sex Pistols or if Guy has. Have you, Guy? Well, anyway. And you get early access to more up-and-coming live events, which I'm hoping we will do from the Rockonteurs.
You can sign up now and find out more at rockonteurs.com.
Hello. Hello. Good evening.
Thank you. This is what you look like.
Yes, exactly.
Sex Pistols sounded amazing.
They sounded absolutely incredible. In fact, I wonder what our good friend David, or as we call him, the Cov, would think.
And I must say, that's a big tune.
Now, I struggled to find my way here, by the way. I'd never been here. Well, maybe I have.
Well, I was actually going to ease you into that gently. Because I know the whole point of tonight is to complete the humiliation that was started 3 years ago with this series. But the thing is, because apart from this, being here tonight, where we are is very, very much your home turf, isn't it?
Yeah, I grew up in Essex Road, which is just parallel to this street here. I used to walk past here when it was the Rex, going on the way to Chapel Market with my mum down the road. And I'd already started rehearsals around here with a band.
You pointed it out, it was a pub around the corner, was it?
It was called the Swinging Sporran. And that's funny nowadays, isn't it?
It sounds like a pub out of Viz.
And because this kind of sets the scene, really, for how extraordinary it was when I came here. The scene is, you know, there was so much sort of pub rock going on. And I'd found myself as a 14-year-old in a band with blokes like who were 29, 30. And everyone wanted to be...
Which now would be seen as suspicious?
Yeah. The band was called the Yew Tree. No, sorry. And everyone wanted to be American, didn't they?
That's right. Did you have dungarees?
No, I didn't have dungarees, no.
You had to think about it, though, didn't you?
Yeah. Because Soul Boys wore dungarees, so I may have worn dungarees at some point.
That's a fair point.
But it was a kind of Americana double denim thing that was going on, you know, and Charlie Gillett on the radio.
Charlie Gillett. Remember Charlie Gillett?
No, never mind. So he'd be playing, like, Little Feet, and it was Laurel Canyon, and all these English bands wanted to be in Laurel Canyon as well.
Right.
Brinsley Schwartz, I mean, who else is there?
Brinsley Schwartz were kind of earlier than that. That was 1970, really. But we're talking about Ducks Deluxe, the Feel Goods, of course.
Bearded Lady.
Bearded Lady, the Kersal Flyers. That was a Ray. I think one of them's in.
And so there was this pub rock, and I was playing pubs as well. And when I was 15, 16, I was in this band playing pubs. And of course, there's this other thing happening, and I think it was Eddie and the Hot Rods that were sort of the first kind of buzz that I got at the Marquee. But even then, you didn't really sense that there was a...
They were the sort of John the Baptists of punk, weren't they?
Yeah, that's a stretch, but yeah. So who was who was St. Christopher?
We're not going to go through the whole iconography.
So it really felt so strange when you started to read in the NME and places about this band, the Sex Pistols. I mean, for a start, I mean, do you remember first hearing that name?
And it was a review in NME. I remember first seeing it. And the really shocking line was it said, "Flared jeans are out." And it was like, what?
Yeah, that was a big thing, wasn't it?
That was a really big thing. It's impossible to try and explain to your children or anyone the fact, the absolute seismic significance of the width of your trousers at the bottom. It was literally life or death.
Yeah. And so I think the first person who told me about this would have been Steve Dagger. So at school, there was a guy called Steve Dagger who was a mate of ours, and he was 3 years older. And he was a total mod. Before the Jam, before Weller, you know, he had the mod haircut. He loved Tamla Motown.
And what's funny back then, I've never actually asked Steve about this. Is back then, how did you even know? All I knew about mod was the photo booklet that came with Quadrophenia. That was the beginning and ending of mod. I mean, where did you find? Where did you look it up?
Yeah, I mean, I remember mods floating by on their scooters outside my house because I was totally, you know, drawn to them because there was the pub next door to where I grew up, and they had a mod night every couple of weeks on a Thursday, and all the mods would turn up on their scooters. Beautiful. But Steve was really into the managers, wasn't he?
You know, that's
Steve
right, Dagger.
You know,
as was I, which is why when we first met, it was actually him I became mates with because he was the interesting one. No. Because I always had a thing about that, and I think most of us might have, is like part of the whole mystique and the whole sexiness of British bands, certainly, was these characters like Andrew Lew Goldham and Kit Lambert, and you know who are just insane ideas people.
And they look great too.
And they look fantastic, and they were as much of the package as the band. And I've got to say I remember because you know when I first knew about Spandau, which was obviously very, very, very early on. But Steve's name came as part of that package. I knew all about him.
He was the sixth member.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so he was the one, he kind of gave me an education, really, as I went along in pop music, in those great mod managers, and, you know, how Brian Epstein broke the Beatles, and, you know, and Kit Lambert broke the Who, you know. I mean, it was what he was excited by, as much as I was excited by guitarists and guitar players. And so I think it would have been one weekend. He we were in the Camden Head, which is just over the road, which is the pub that the Kinks rehearsed in, by the way. We found that out on one of our episodes talking to Dave Davis. Yeah. And he just put this flyer out, and he went, "We've got to go and see this." I can see he's looking at me now. And he said, we've got to go and see this. This is, this is the Sex Pistols. And I don't know how much I grasped what the Sex Pistols were at the time. And maybe I'd read that review.
Well,
I don't know.
Steve said to me earlier, he said, I remember when it was Steve, whoever came in and said, "We're going to go see this band. They're going to be the new Rolling Stones. What are they called? The Sex Pistols." And he said, "It just sounded stupid."
I mean, I thought it was extraordinary because it was great. It was a name I couldn't say in front of my parents. And that's what rock and roll's about, right? But he knew about it because there was this kid in his class, in his year, who'd left school early because he loved movies. He was so impassioned by movies and wanted to make movies. And he ended up making movies eventually. He ended up running Palace Pictures, and he's still to this day. He's just flown back from Cannes to be with us tonight. And Steve Woolley.
That's a great thing to be able to say, isn't it? At least once in your life about, he's flown back from Cannes to be with us here tonight. Thank you.
Steve got out of school and became Steve Woolley and became assistant manager here under the managership of Roger Austin, and it was a bit of a scene here, wasn't it, Steve? It was a bit of a scene. It was where you'd have late night films running, and it was a really trendy cinema, and he had told Steve Dagger that the Pistols were going to be playing that night, and I mean, I think there's a microphone there. You might want to just fill us in a bit, Steve. This is Steve Dagger.
I heard about it from Steve. We used to come and see Steve for a drink at the Swinging Sporran over the road. And we would meet during the interval. Steve was busy earlier on getting the movies up. And once or twice, Roger Austin came over to join us for drinks and mentioned this band that his friend Malcolm had that were going to be the new Rolling Stones. Then he came in one night and said, I'm going to put them on at the Screen on the Green. And so that was how I knew about it. Steve, I don't know, you can explain about the Roger and how...
This is Steve Woolley.
Steve Woolley, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you. I was like Steve, I was 19, you know, like yourself, you know, how old were you, 17, 16?
16.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Roger was a bit of a force of nature, and he was very, very close to Malcolm. And I had hair down to my bum and was really into jazz at that time, especially sort of late Miles Davis, so that kind of jazz.
That's very cinema, though, isn't it?
Yeah, Coltrane, yeah. Parker. I loved that. I'd gone and moved away from all the music, all the stuff that I loved in the early 70s, and was into jazz, and I had no idea what punk was, or the Pistols, or the Clash and the Buzzcocks. I didn't know any of these people at all. And Roger used to wear all the sex clothes and the leather trousers, and he was at the height of it before any of us knew what the height of it was. And he announced this all-nighter that was going to take place here at the Screen on the Green. But we had to build a stage. The stage was about two planks wide. I mean, imagine about a quarter of what you're sitting on there. And the three bands had to precariously balance on it. And they all brought the scaffold in here and built the stage. And it all unfurled before my eyes, like it did with you. I mean, I swear, this sounds crazy, but within a week, I'd gone and shorn all of my hair off. The effect of that night was enthusiasmic on me personally.
Yeah, yeah.
And it also politicized me, strangely enough, as it did a lot of people, the punk movement. But I shaved my hair off, dyed it black, went down to a shop called Sex in the King's Road. I bought a pair of bondage trousers, and that's it. That summer of 76 was extraordinary. And I couldn't believe I was being paid to stand at the back and watch films. And it was a trendy cinema, and it still sort of is. But it actually is exactly the same building. The loo was just there. The exit is just there, where all the kids from Anna Scher, including you probably, Gary, used to bunk in.
Well, that loo is important in the story because I think during the show, when the Pistols were on stage, Johnny pulled the microphone right at the beginning and smashed his tooth. And towards the end of the show, Steve Dagger, you were in the loo.
Yeah, and he was struggling with blood all over his.
He went, "Sir, I've knocked my fucking tooth out."
Yeah. He was not happy.
I just think, you know, I was a bit scared. I sat at the back there with Steve and with Steve Norman, who, you know, we formed the band Spandau Ballet with. And because the front here was quite exotic, extraordinary bunch, you know, it was no one, I didn't know anyone's names. It's like Susie Sue, obviously.
Bromley contingent.
The Bromley contingent. So there would have been, I guess Billy Idol was here, but I know Philip Salon was here.
All right.
Because they all go up on stage and dance.
Sue Catwoman.
There are actually some great photographs. If anyone wants to go, you know, can be bothered to look, you can go online. And that night was very well. There was a terrific photographer here. Yeah. I'm not sure it was, but it's very well captured. And the cinema was full. I mean, a lot of people were here.
Oh, it was full.
I
thought the first one wasn't, and then the second.
No, it was
time
full.
I
think it was a full.
It was pretty much. There was a heat. I mean, the name Sex Pistols would, you know, that would help. Mm-mm. I mean, because nobody knew who they were, but. It was an extraordinary night, and there were reviews. I remember someone said, Charles Shaw Murray said of The Clash of that night that they're supposedly a garage band. I suggest they go back into the garage, lock all the doors, and turn the car on.
But the funny thing is, it was a bit more succinct than that. It was, they're a garage band who should be sent back to the garage with the engine running.
Yeah.
But the funny thing is, Guy, I'd never heard of The Clash. I'd never heard of the Buzzcocks. You know, this is the first, I think it was the second Clash gig. They'd done one private gig.
Yeah.
Buzzcocks had never played in London before.
And Steve, you were saying earlier, and punk hadn't been coined, or co-opted rather, because obviously I think the New York scene was called punk. This wasn't called punk
here. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But no one was dancing. There was no pogoing. I remember. I mean, listen, these boys are going to know everything in a minute. But my memory is that everyone was pretty much sitting down. And what was really funny, I thought, was there was this kind of snarling arrogance from the Bromley contingent, who were just sort of taking the piss out of, especially of the Pistols when they came on. They thought it was hysterical, and there'd be like this banter going backwards and forwards between the band. Nevertheless, it changed my life. But why weren't you there?
I was 14, right? And I don't want to get schmaltzy or anything, but I will say, I mean, my father had died literally just over a month before, so I was a bit all over the place. But I had, but to show what the times were, because I did look it up, and 8 days before the gig here, I'd gone to Nebworth to see the Rolling Stones.
Right. You were old school.
I was old school.
Well we all did. I went to see the Rolling Stones, exactly. And my brother went to see Pink Floyd.
There was Rolling Stones with Hot Tuna, and Lynyrd Skynyrd, who I thought were brilliant, and wow, and I can't know who else. I can't remember else. But what the thing I do remember is that the Stones were so late, and
it was 10cc as well.
10cc, that's right.
And the Stones came on so late.
They were so late that they.
But everybody, I remember we had. With my friend called Ron, who worked here, Ron and his partner, and we made a chicken with certain special ingredients in it. And we were trying to time, you know, it was our picnic. We were trying to time the consumption of the chicken at the point where the Stones will come on. But they were so late, and we were so wasted by the time we came on, that I've never forgiven Mick Jagger ever since, actually, because...
I'm sorry you can't see Steve. We should have had him up on stage if we'd known. But
but it was awful. It was insulting.
It was absolutely terrible. In fact, because the people I was with, because it was so late, we had to leave after about three numbers.
Well, this was late. This was midnight, mate.
Yeah, and but it was meant,
we didn't
but it
get
was
out
meant
of here till 5 a.m. It was light, and my mum and dad were going to go crazy.
Yeah, but you were at home. We were in fucking Nebworth. Yeah. And I was with my mate Martin Glover, who we now know as Youth, and he was actually on holiday with me. We were on a family holiday sailing in Holyhead, and we'd had to get super double begged permission to come down for this gig from Wales, and then we had to go straight back to fucking Holyhead.
So the Buzzcocks, I thought, were amazing, you know, because it was quite an arty band, and in a way they sort of reminded me how Devoto did, because Peter Shelley was only on guitar then, and he wasn't singing at that time, and so it was Steve was playing bass, and Howard Devoto was very sort of arty kind of Eno-ish type character, and I mean, and just extraordinary succinct songs. I mean, that was the other thing, because we were used to watching bands playing guitar solos, and suddenly it was just these pop tunes that were like over in 2 minutes. And I remember the Clash coming on in kind of suits that were splattered with kind of Jackson Pollock
boiler
paint.
Suits. Was it boiler suits or suits?
Well, I thought it was boiler suits, and then someone said it was suits the other day. So your mind does play tricks, you know, you're sort of remembering these faded Polaroids, don't you? And apparently there was already competition. They didn't want the Pistols to know what they were wearing, and they went in the back, round the back yard to get changed. But it's probably because there's no dressing room here. And then the Pistols were, I mean, I just remember Steve being, you know, this guitar hero. In fact, he had Guitar Hero written on his amp, you know, and kind of doing Townsend type move. I mean, that was the thing. My memory is Stepping Stone, because I didn't know Anarchy. I didn't know any of those songs. But I knew Stepping Stone, Small Faces. And their version...
The Monkees.
Sorry. But it was their version by Small Faces.
Oh, no, hang on. No, it was Small Faces.
And I just remember it being... we'll ask Glenn when he comes up. And I remember it being extraordinary. You know, it was such a great moment in the show. I left here. I went into rehearsals a few days later with my double denim band. And I said, I'm leaving. I've just seen the most extraordinary thing I'll ever see in my life, and I just want to form another band. And Steve Norman and I went into school the week later and went into the music room and found a drummer, John Keeble, and found a singer. We chose him because he had a leather jacket and he could have been a punk. And that was Tony Hadley, and we just played fast, you know, versions of Beatles numbers and Who numbers and Small Faces, and I started writing.
Brilliant.
Changed our lives. Seminal gig it was.
You took a load of Beatles songs and just stuck I Don't Wanna at the start of the title. Yeah. I Don't Wanna Hold Your Hand.
I Don't Wanna Twist and Shout.
I Don't Wanna Yesterday.
We were very serious. Everyone who did punk was fucking serious.
I know. Can I just... There's one story. This is your story.
Right.
But I want to tell it.
Yeah.
Because it's one of my favourite punk stories ever. Gary telling me about... He said, going to see this punk band. And the thing is, there was always the lads in the band, weren't there, who just wanted to do loads of greasy pink sulfate and get pissed. And then there was a really serious one who was the writer. And was it, you said this guy came on and said, I'm really sorry. It's been a really hard day. Things are really tough for me. My dad died. So I've written a song about it. 1, 2, 3, 4. God, dead dad, dead dad, dead dad. God, dead dad, dead dad.
That's absolutely true. You can't buy that on record anywhere.
I think as well.
Steve Diggle, the Buzzcocks. He was there. Let's get him on.
Welcome to the Rock on Tours.
Okay, guys, I'm ready. That's a big tune for sure. I actually wrote that originally for Tina Turner.
Of course, I had gone and found Joni Mitchell down in Florida and brought her back.
I've listened to a few of them and they've been really good, man. I'm sitting in the back of the car coming into London. They're brilliant.
That caused a big problem in the band, actually. I was having too much fun.
Thank you guys for still being around, still making music, still being into it, and doing this podcast. It's fabulous.
Well, I get the feeling that us three should go for a pint. That's what I think.
I'm in a band now. It's called Roxy Music.
You know this thing about the 10,000 hours of experience?
Oh, yeah.
Get good at something. When we recorded Arnold Lane, we'd done about 50 hours.
The Rock on Tours podcast with Gary Kemp and Guy Pratt.
Keep on rocking!
Yes. Thank you. Thank you, mate. Thank you for doing this.
It's a pleasure. I mean, doing this gig, it was our second time in London. But I remember coming here, and obviously we were based in Manchester, and everybody in the audience was dressed up, the bright orange hair, all the bondage gear, everything. And I thought, this is crystal. The night here had crystallised punk, really, or the image of it and the clothes and all the feeling of it, because in Manchester, it was about the music then, and punk wasn't that really well known then, It was just like, I remember walking here, we were sat outside in an old transit van, sharing a bottle of cider, because that's all we could afford, and walked in here, and like I say, everybody was dressed up, all glamorous in the punk stuff. I thought, this is crystallised punk, this is the moment, something's happening with it,
But were you thinking of the word punk? Because that's the thing. The Buzzcocks start. You were just in like complete isolation. Is that what it felt in Manchester? And was it this thing of we desperately need something new, or there was just you were just starting a band?
The landscape was barren, really. Musically for everybody, really. It was like you had bands like Yes and stuff like that, but even all that progressive stuff had run its course, really. And you're coming up to 21, and there was a million people on the dole who'd coming up. There was 10 years. All that kind of stuff. And I thought, you need some excitement, I'd grown up in the 60s, but, Little Richard and Chuck Berry and all, the Kinks, the Beatles, the Who. So I was a kid.
You had three scooters, all that didn't you?
Stuff. Sorry?
You had three scooters, didn't you?
I did, yeah.
You were a mod before Weller.
No, but you weren't.
Yeah, before Weller. I'm 4 years older than me. It's his birthday, Dave.
It is.
Happy birthday, Paul. I did mine 2 weeks ago.
But you were like Steve, you were a mod, not at mod time.
I was a mod. The thing was, I worked in a garage for a couple of weeks selling petrol to get some money. So I had a scooter. Then a guy came in and he said, give me £16 for an LI150, the Quadrophenia scooter. I had a TV175. So I got that. A few weeks later, a priest came in. He said, I've got an old scooter, in the vestry or whatever it is. And I gave him £4 for it. It was a Vespa GS, real collector's item.
Yeah, to clean the bats off.
So a Vespa from the vestry.
Legend is that you were sort of at the Lesser Free Trade Hall, the famous...
Yes.
But your first ever gig was at the Lesser Free Trade Hall.
Were you there on the first one, just see the pistols?
Yes. Oh, so that's where I met Pete and Howard. That's where we all met. What happened was, so I'd lost my scooter license. I won't go into the details of that.
Oh, go on.
So I did a weekend in jail, It was my Kierkegaard moment of realisation that
I've got to do, you know, I was in solitary confinement, you know, like Jesus in the wilderness. I was 17 years old. And I thought, I've got to figure out what I do in my life. I've ended up in a jail only for a weekend. I've been in worse motels in the early days, but I mean, and I thought, you know, now I'm grounded to the pub and the guitar. I'd bought a £6 Spanish guitar, but I was forever, you know, picking girls up on the scooters. So I started to think, you know, I played a £6 Spanish guitar. So what I realised, every time you had to tune up with the pitch pipes and all that kind of stuff. Every time I tuned this guitar, I played a chord and it went out of tune. But when I realised, I learned to play Beethoven's Ninth.
That's Beethoven's
on,
yes.
On one string and a bit on the other. A bit on the other. And so I started just jamming on two notes everywhere, you know. And
it wasn't the boredom, beginning of the boredom solo, was
but,
it?
But that, that kind of thing. So
but the thought that that actually cut... this one of those brilliant things, isn't it? This fantastic two-note guitar style.
Yeah.
Absolute strict minimum. It comes from Beethoven's Ninth Symphony.
Well, it was just like, you know...
Which actually, don't want to get too political, but it's actually the anthem of the European Union.
Using your limitations and all that stuff. But, I mean, if it wasn't for that guitar... Because there were things, you're jamming on two strings, and in all Buzzcocks songs, it's almost like a separate motif somewhere, you know, a little guitar tune of its own, you know. Apart from that two-note one, it's, you know, it's sprinkled all up. And I realised about 5 years later, or when we got going, it all comes from that guitar. If I'd have had a Les Paul like the posh kids in Cheshire had, you know, I wouldn't have come up with that, you know, in the face of adversity and stuff and everything else. I come up with that. The posh kids sold their Les Pauls and they go, no, I'm going skiing now, you know.
So, Steve, what did you think?
Sorry for a pair of skis.
What did you think when you saw the Pistols, were you, that first gig?
So the next thing, I found a guy in the paper. I found a guy in the paper. I thought, I'd written this song, Fast Cars, and a couple of things. I was rehearsing with a couple of guys around the corner, but they had jobs. I knew they didn't mean it, you know. You had to know where you were going with this stuff or have. You know, you had to be a bit defiant with it and everything. They was just doing it as a hobby, and I thought, I phoned a guy on a paper, and I said, meet me outside the Free Trade Hall, because there's a good pub round the corner, Cox's Bar. I'm stood outside the Free Trade Hall, there's a bloke in the Elvis Revival stuff, in all leather, Malcolm McLaren. Said
yeah, full leathers, yeah.
Yeah, full leather, you know, that Elvis kind of... And he said, they're near the Sex Pistols. I said, I know, I've heard of that, but you know, I'm waiting to meet someone, I'm forming a band. Because my motive at the time was, I went to form a band like The Who's, smash the guitars, tell the audience to fuck off, and all that, you know. I didn't need Johnny Rotten to tell me that. I knew, you know, you had a hard time in Manchester growing up, you know, fighting in the bars and all the things. And me reading Proust and Dostoevsky on the sofa, and my mum going, you need to get a job, you can't be doing that. You know? I got crucified, you know what I mean? And so I'm sitting outside the Free Trade Hall, and he said that they're in here. I said, what do you mean? So somehow I followed him in, you know. He said they played Substitute by The Who, and I thought, well, that sounds good. I went through the doorway. Pete Shelley's collecting tickets on the door. So we had a quick chat, and I said, I'll meet you in the bar. And then they was expecting somebody else. they put an ad in some magazine. So we're talking at cross purposes in the bar. I thought, I remember saying some things on the phone, but not, you know, it didn't all make sense. But it was like a Brian Rich farce.
Oh, right.
But we sat at the back. That first Sex Pistols gig was kind of empty. I think there was only about 20 people there, really.
18, isn't it? 18, well, 18 is the number, apparently.
Yeah, I didn't count them any. Yeah. We sat at the back going, you know, let's write our own songs. Let's, you know, talking about forming a group as we're watching the Sex Pistols, you know. And,
Well, so you weren't paying attention to them at all?
Well, we were. No, it's like, you know, the powerfulness of Steve Jones' guitar, you know, Glenn's bass banging away, and this kind of bloke that looked like, with horrible teeth, looked like, you know, an extra from the New York Dolls or something, you know, running and raving. You've got to remember, that was so new at that moment in time, you know. You know, because on the old Grey Whistle set, they started playing lutes, lyres, and, yeah, you know. dressing in cod pieces and that. It was a long way from Little Richard. You remember? It was like, hold on a minute. I used to love the Whistle Test, seeing the Stones and the people like that there. Suddenly wearing cod pieces and playing, you know, it's like I'm in Elizabethan time.
Did you meet Howard and Pete?
So, yeah. So, I met Pete there. We're talking about, we sat at the back watching that first Pistols gig. So, and also Howard, I think he was doing the likes, yeah.
Because they'd sort of semi put it on, hadn't they?
I think it was Howard was on some college course, met them in a club in Chelsea or whatever. He was kind of, you know, they probably had like a column inch in the NME at the time. You know, there's a little band played in Chelsea to make all the Sex Pistols. Howard had met them and said, if you want to do a gig in Manchester, we'll put some posters up. And so that's what they did, and I met them there, you know. And a couple of weeks later, or maybe a month or so later, they came back. But by this time, we'd rehearsed and we opened up for them, you know.
Hang on, 2 weeks?
Well, I mean, a few weeks. I'm 68, the time's, you know, so time's what immaterial to me now.
What
I don't know I'm going to live or I'm going to die, you know. I mean that mid-phase.
Is that the one, the second one, is that the one where No, I think that was the first one that everyone was at. But yeah, Mick Hucknall told us, was it the second one where basically the split up with Howard happened on stage? And there was a fight?
No, on stage.
On
the second one, no.
No.
No, there was no fight, yeah.
But you had the sort of songs from Spiral Scratch and at that point, didn't you, when you came to play here?
Well, the day after I met them, the guy I was supposed to meet, the guy they were supposed to meet, we didn't meet them. They were still outside. They're probably still there.
They're still there, yeah.
They're probably still there. So the next day, I went to Howard's flat, and me, Pete and Howard rehearsed Orgasmatic Boredom and stuff like that. Through one little amp, you know, Howard was screaming away. I was on the bass and, you know, Pete doing a guitar. It sounded terrible, but it was exciting.
Yeah, but you just said Orgasmatic Boredom. I mean, these are songs that are still really inside me. I know so well.
Yeah.
You know, all the kids this, making it.
It come out, this one little amp with three of us plugging into it, you know. We was always interested in noise as well. There's always some discordant bits in a Buzzcocks, a lot of Buzzcocks.
Well, there are, but what's the interesting thing is, I remember when I first discovered the Buzzcocks, was this beautiful, perfect pop buried in it as well. That's one thing you had above everyone else.
Well, both me and Pete, you know, we was that 60s generation growing up with the Beatles, Stones, all them people. But we, you know, we like the Velvet Underground for the arty things. And also, you know, we like Can and Noi and all that kind of stuff as well. Actually, when we first met, we went out for a night and saw Can in Manchester University. Me, Howard and Pete, you know.
Because there is something very arty about coming up with a song called Boredom and having two notes as the guitar solo that go on 60-odd times.
Well, yeah, I think it comes
from... I mean, you're making a statement.
Yes.
Yeah, you know, I forget which philosopher or what sort of existential book, but the sense of boredom comes from that. And then the Orgasmatic would have come from a William Burroughs kind of thing. So there's those elements, you know.
Can I just say, this is fantastic. We've come in to talk about this Night of Anakin Kell. So far, your references that you've come out with tonight have been Proust, Dostoevsky, Beethoven, Yeats, Stockhausen, and Burroughs.
Yeah.
Mate.
Yeah.
What do you think?
You
I'm
are the most
idiot.
Arty, cultured person I've ever met in my life.
I'm as working class. I'm as working class as they
Don't
come.
Don't go home, Glenn.
Well, that was the difference with Buzzcocks. But then again, Joel Stummer was nicking things from books, you know, and all that stuff. But it wasn't that. But for me, as a working class kid, you know, I wasn't good enough to be a footballer. I used to get my head kicked in, you know, in pubs. You know, there's a lot of fighting going on in them pubs. And so the books was a refuge and an answer. So that was important. I'd buy a record and I'd buy a book, you know. You buy the hit single of Dostoevsky, Grand Funny.
No,
along with the Rolling Stones, who are, you know.
People in punk.
But that was your only defence, wasn't it? A working class guy.
Yeah. People in punk don't normally mention him, but it was Bowie in your life.
Oh, yeah, massive. I've still got the ticket from when I went to see him. And, you know, because, you know, Bowie was experimental, inspirational.
And he introduced Iggy Pop to us, really, didn't he?
Yes.
To a certain extent.
Yes, he did.
And Lou Reed.
Because people used to say, if you had the Stooges album, nobody could get it anywhere, you know. You could get, you know, Funhouse and all that kind of stuff for ages, you know. You'd hear it in a club, some DJ might have had it, but it was very hard to get hold of. But I remember listening to Diamond Dogs with Pete. When we first met, he had a, you know, he was living in a basement, and, you know, we listened to Diamond Dogs and stuff like that at the time. And I know Pete was very influenced by Bowie as well. You know, I mean, it was so... He was a massive influence.
When you finished that night, your set, did you go straight away or did you sit and watch the Clash?
I remember, like I said, we sat outside in a transit van and came out, got the van to come in, and Mick Jones was at the door and he had a black coat with a mirror broken, you know. And I thought, is that lucky? And I can still remember that pitch. And he's like, all right, Steve, nice to meet you, you know, and all that. Because I'm a massive Clash fan, you know, same as the Pistols. But I can still visualise that moment, you know.
Just out there, you'll walk past the ghosts later.
Because you've already said Van, because I was wondering, because you said this is like your third gig or something, whatever you
Yeah,
you
we,
said,
we'd done the Roxy about a month before. I Googled it up today.
I was, you never Wikipedia yourself because you just keep saying stuff about yourself that just isn't true. But because I was wondering, because you've already said.
Oh, no, they say we started in Bolton. I didn't go to Bolton until I was 37.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one of a kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I really think it's time to get on the guy who, you know, certainly helped change my life when he was in the starring act. Saw him as that wee boy, didn't we, just a minute ago on the screen?
Little cherub.
I know.
Little cherub.
He's still a lovely man.
And gorgeous.
Let's get him on. Glenn Matlock.
Testing, 1, 2. Hello.
Glenn, you're a former raconteur as well.
Yes.
You've done this before.
Yes, I was one of your earlier ones, I think.
You were.
I did volunteer myself because it was in the middle of lockdown. I thought, I've got to do fucking something. Oh, they're doing that. I'll see if they want somebody.
It's but nice, you know what? We felt that.
Yeah, it probably came across. But you know what has come across to me is somebody was saying earlier that there was no stage here. There was no stage here when we first played, and the Clash played on the consideration that they built a stage, and they said, oh, we'll hire a stage, and we said, no, you got to build it. And then when we did walk on the stage, I realised it probably wasn't a very good idea, because it was like really ramshackle, you know, imagine Mick Jones with a spanner in it.
They built something that would hold for their set, but no longer.
Probably, yeah.
This wasn't the stage.
No, it was something else, and it's a lot higher than it used to be. Right. And there was loads and loads of kind of scuzzy seats.
I mean, there was a rumour that the Clash and the Buzzcocks didn't get the. I don't want to start a fight here now, boys.
No, do go on.
But the Clash and the Buzzcocks didn't get the full PA, and because you had your sound guy out there, and the Sex Pistols got the four.
But that's kind of standard. That's about right.
That's pretty standard.
That seems to be what goes on.
Standard, right?
But I'm always this side of PA, so I don't really know what it was like. But probably you have to speak to Dave Goodman or Kim Thraves, who were our sound guys at the time. And if you ever see any pictures,
but the thing is,
they had a PA company. We met them, and they had a van. And Dave Goodman was kind of, you know, he's a pretty good sound guy. He used to play bass, and he played in like kind of soul bands and stuff. And he knew the ropes around England. And Kim was his sidekick. But if you ever see any early pictures of the Sex Pistols, you know, with their roadies and stuff, there's a guy who's like a really well-dressed cat weasel. And that's Kim Thraves. He was like this really ace kind of hippie. And it was kind of funny with bell-bottom trousers and a little beard and long hair. And yeah, so it was a real strange kind of...
But when you see that film that we played earlier... Are you completely separated from that now? You're immune to it. You've seen it so many times. Or does it still give you the buzz?
It's a long time ago now. That you're talking about the Anarchy
Clip. It still
clip.
Gives me a buzz.
Yeah, and that's a mime, isn't it, that one?
Yeah, and that was actually...
And you break a string, which is quite impressive on a
what
mime.
In that?
It looks like you...
He breaks his string on the...
the one we just watched it. I saw it. There's a bit where he's got a broken
string.
Well,
then he's always breaking his string.
Because
he broke his...
Well, on the bass.
It goes.
I was saying, bass players breaking strings is impressive.
Hang on, I didn't come here to be insulted about...
I'm not, you're being complimented.
I didn't break a fucking string on it.
You're being complimented. That's a compliment, mate.
It might have been spittle hanging down. You invite a punk. If that's what you want, that's what's going to happen, right?
Was it Frank Boff's spittle?
Yeah, it was probably mine. But that video was shot by
Mike Mansfield,
yeah.
Wow.
And it was quite and when Q we went there and, pistol, it, and he hopefully. Shot it, I think before he was doing Supersonic a bit later on, and we just went in and out of the studio. We'd signed to EMI by then, and he made John stand behind Paul deliberately, and it really really annoyed John. So he got a great performance out of him for it, which was kind of cool.
It's great seeing Cookie that much. It's really
well, yeah. Why not? He's the Dave Clark Five of punk. Right? Was it so there's only one of them.
But was it the band that you imagined you wanted to be in when you? I mean, what I mean by that is because you'd done those a few gigs, and it was a lot of the crowd, Vivian and Malcolm's kind of shop crowd, and Bromley Contingent as we know them. It didn't kind of look like. Was it the lads you wanted or?
I didn't really know what I wanted. I think all of us in the band, when we started to play and get something together, very originally, when I met Stephen Paul, I overheard that I was looking for a bass player, and I actually said, not that I'm a bass player, I said, I've got a bass. Right? And they said, oh, what bands do you like? And I said, I like the Faces. And that was their favourite band. And about a week later, I went with my girlfriend at the time to the Gaumont State Theatre in Kilburn High Road, and Ronnie Wood was doing a gig. I think it was the New Barbarians thing. Right, and I had really cheap tickets, so I automatically went right up, you know, one level, up the next level, up the next level. But the lights were off, so he obviously hadn't sold the thing out. And just as I was going back down to the next level with Julie Billiard from Kensal Green, I heard this scurrying going, what's kind of noise? And all of a sudden it was Stephen Paul and a couple of their mates from Shepherd's Bush. They bunked in over the roof. They're all covered in. I thought, and these are the guys I was going to start playing with. I thought, I like these guys. They've got something going for them. You know, and at that stage, Steve was having a go at being the singer, and he was like a bad version of Steve Ellis, kind of really, or Tom Jones. And it wasn't quite right, but he started learning the guitar, and then we found John. But we just knew what we didn't like. We didn't want to, you know, we were talking about Genesis and Yes and all that. We didn't want to be like that. We didn't want to be like somebody else. But we was going to do it anyway. And it just come out how it came out. He was saying about that Beatles thing earlier on, I don't want to hold your hand. You know, we'd learn covers. And sometimes you get it right. Sometimes they're a bit too hard. And it sounds like something else. And that's the process of beginning songwriting. Well, Substitute was another one. We learned to play a little bit more by then, but you know, it was all songs with no fun. We was hip to the Stooges. I'm not your stepping stone. We did What You Gonna Do About It by the Small Faces.
Oh, that's what I was getting.
And yeah. John's staying it to. I want you to know that I hate you.
Oh, well, yeah, exactly.
As only he would, you know. Yeah, but yeah. So it was that. But he was starting to write, and then he was going on about Dostoevsky and people like. I mean, I had that kind of thing. I was in sort of the French kind of writers, you know, like Camus and Jean Cocteau. That was, you know, you used to say you're a fan of the Richards, you told me in the
guide. Yeah,
I mean,
always.
Ghost of Princes and Towers is heavily influenced by Les Enfants Terribles by Jean Cocteau. Yeah. So, you know, if you're a working class bloke, it doesn't mean you can't read a book. You know,
that's all it was.
Bring these things to it.
You know? I read them because I thought when they come from his interviews, Oxford and Cambridge, we'll fucking have them.
That's
you know
it,
mean?
Yeah.
And I do. You know what?
Fucking don't talk to me about Plato. We'll fucking have you.
I think you're right because I think we would go and have those books as weapons.
Yeah, that's what it was.
That we were greater than they thought we were.
Yeah.
You know, it was knowledge was
yeah,
power.
Knowledge is power. That was it. You know, because you. Fucking grow up in a tub like yourself, round the corner, you know. Right? It's like, that was, well, you normally strapped along with your guitar. It's like, well, fucking come for us with that. You want to know about something, you know what I mean? We deal with that shit, but we got the songs.
That's true. Well, but also, Glenn, you know, when punk was starting out, and the people, you lived in the suburbs or something like that, and one of them,
Not in Collingdale.
Was putting us up for the night. It was people used to walk around with a toothbrush in their top pocket. It meant you had nowhere to keep, you know. But there were cinemas that had late night movies or all night movies on, and it saved you having to get the last train home and stuff. But there was here, there was the Electric, but the Electric as well, and Acklam Hall, which then became Subterranea, and it was like a social club thing. But they would have all night movies on, but they always showed L'Atalante, Cocteau's Belle and Lebet, you know, stuff like that. Zero de Conduit by it. So it was all that kind of French kind of thing going on. And in fact, I remember sitting in the Acklam Hall with Mick Jones, and there's a scene in La Belle and Lebet where it's a bit like the princess and, the, you know, in, oh, I don't know, but the Ugly Sisters or something, but she's
Cinderella.
Got two brothers and she's been enticed up to the castle to meet the Beast. And they're taking a mickey out of her in French with subtitles. And the subtitle comes up. She goes, "You two are just wastrels." And Mick Jones turns to me and went, "That's us." Because they were trying to get their thing together at the time. And there was another thing going on. It's not a secret, but our first Pistols gigs were at art schools, which I booked. Yeah. You know, St. Martin's, Central School of Art. So those people were part of the coterie thing, as well as the Bromley contingent. People as well. So it was all a mixture of people who didn't quite know what they wanted to do, but they were trying to find them, buy themselves some breathing space to work it out with some like-minded people. And
I'm
I thought that was a very cool kind of
how
thing.
You ended up with a job at such a strange clothing shop. And was it like outrageously expensive? Could normal kids afford that kind of
well,
those kind of
things
clothes?
Are only no. outrageously expensive if you haven't got any money, right, for a start. So let's... It's a sliding scale.
Bondage pants were 80 quid. I remember going, you could buy a house in Manchester for 80 quid.
No, but like I said,
honestly, I remember going to that shop
Vivian
and thinking,
Westwood
fuck.
Prices.
You know,
it's like, it's based on a slight.
My,
with
my brother would buy a shirt. He was at Old University. He'd rip the sleeve off, a pink shirt, rip it off, and spray paint it. 30 pence, you know.
That's the way to do it. And then Vivian would sell it for 30 quid.
Yeah. But it had to be done, didn't it? It's like the 60s block of flats. They had to be built to realise it didn't work. You know.
Yeah, and the other thing like that, you were saying about the Clash hiding round the corner with their clothes. I reckon they did it because they didn't want to show me. Because I ended up living in Denmark Street with Steve Jones, where we used to rehearse. And I had a pair of drainpipe trousers, the only ones I had from Malcolm's. And although I got them a bit cheaper, they were still a lot of money out of my one day a week's work at the store. And me and Steve decided to paint the ceiling. We decided that I ended up having to do all the work. And I got white paint on the black jeans and I couldn't get them off. Now, a few years before that, I remembered an episode of a hospital program called Emergency Ward 10. I don't know if anybody remembers that. And there was a scene in it where one of the nurses spills ink down her light blue nurse's top. So she can't get it out, so she dyes it dark blue. And she got in trouble because that was the matron's colour to wear the dark blue top. But I thought, I can't get
this
paint off.
Was born,
I just put more paint on it, right? And I came up with a Jackson Pollock idea. And then Paul Simonon, who's since admitted that, he nicked my idea for that.
Fantastic.
So I think those are out of back because they didn't.
It's a rock on turf scoop for you, people.
Yeah. That's amazing.
On the other hand, I will admit that Jackson Pollock actually came up with Jackson Pollock.
How much did you gig before you played here?
We probably done about 20 shows before then in art colleges, weird kind of places. We hired a sex club in El Paradiso in Soho. We'd possibly been up north. When did we play in Manchester? I can't even remember that.
Pardon? There was a scene. Did you feel there was a scene happening?
The only place I thought there was a scene, and I was up in Liverpool the night before last and sort of chatting about this, and we played at a club called Eric's, and played upstairs, and there weren't that many people there. Possibly so, but I can't remember meeting him then. And we was packing up the van because we had to drive back over the night, and I wanted to get another beer to take with me, and there was these stairs, and I went down, and there was all these people down there who hadn't come to our gig, and there was a band going on, and there was a band called The Yachts, and there was people like Clive Langer and Betty Bright there, and Jane Casey, and there was a scene, and I was like, from London, hey, they've got a scene outside London, a bit kind of big-headedly. That was the first place that I saw something else going on. And then when we went to Manchester a bit later on, we kind of realised there was a...
Well, as a Manchester team, Vara was doing the gig with you, suddenly Manchester came alive, you know.
Well, you sort of kick-started that, didn't you?
That inspired all the provinces. Then there was a Scottish scene, a Liverpool scene. But it started in Manchester. I think punk started in Manchester because when you guys played and we opened up for you, all the journalists came down for the free fucking drinks and all the hotel, all that. And reviewed us, coming to review you guys, and was surprised that we were there, and it put us on the map as well. But that was the first real publicity, I think, you know. So if Jesus was born in Bethlehem, I think Punk was born in Manchester, really. Oh. Even though I've lived in London half my life, now.
Were you nervous? Did you think, Christ, the Clash are too good? And was there any sense
Fuck
of
off.
That?
Who fought the Clash?
Pistols blew everyone
away. That's why I was talking
about one at a time.
Yeah. Talking about the clothes, the Clash were posh, really, because I remember Bernard Rhodes coming with all that, zips and designer gear. It's like, we had a fucking shop at Oxfam, you know what I mean? Black shoes for 30 pence, spray them green. And so. And then Bernard would be there with all the schmutter going, I've got you the new white outfits with the zips. Fucking hell.
No, but the reason I asked about how many gigs done before you played is because there's recording of this gig. You're perfect, yeah. You're done. It sounds like the album. It sounds really, really polished and really powerful. It's as good as the album.
Well, we worked at it, We worked at being simple, really. Yeah. And practice. We had nothing better to do apart from meet. We was lucky enough to have our own rehearsal place in Denmark Street. We would get together nearly every day, if only to find out nobody's got a new idea. But you didn't have to wait a week to then go somewhere else and take all your gear there, set up, start playing to find out nobody's got a new idea. And it would take, you haven't got an idea, you haven't got a fucking idea. Well, you'd come up with one, you'd do it again the next day, and you'd go over and over it, and we got good.
Was you being you, or was it an act? I mean, did you develop some kind of image thing? Because it's kind of outrageous as well, wouldn't it? Did you develop that or just get in the room and go, wow?
No, it's just we picked.
Just natural.
We was hanging out at Malcolm's shop. I was working there. People would take what they looked from. I mean, originally it was a teddy bear shop called Let It Rock.
Johnny had an extraordinary.
And it started moving to becoming sex. I kind of helped make the sign and stuff. And there was all these weird kind of people coming in. But people would take what they fancied from it and then add to it. And then when we met John, he kind of had that kind of safety pin thing going on. But he kind of got that from Ian Dury.
Did he get it from Ian Dury, the safety
pin? Yeah.
Wow. Or
the razor blade knocking down. Yeah. So, hanging down from his ear. But there were certain things. There was the pub rock thing. And most of these bands wanted to be part of the Laurel Canyon scene. And if you've ever got up there, it's not that much cop anyway, right? But there were a few things that were good, like the Feel Goods, Kilburn and the Arrows, which then became the Blockheads. The Stranglers were on the tail end of that. They were kind of cool. There was a few other things going on as well. I was a big fan of a band called the Sensational Alex Harvey Band, who really knew how to put on a show In fact, I went to see him at the London Palladium. I saw him from in front of like four or five people at Fulham Palace Road ground. And well, actually, this is funny. And I started following their career, and I was getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And then they come in Malcolm shop when I was working there, like through the week once. And it was in the winter, and it's probably October, November, so it was cold outside. And they got overcoats on, right? And as I'm serving them, and Chris Glenn used to get, he had his droogie look, he would get like Dago socks from there and stuff to go with his codpiece. But it was a droogie kind of taking a rise out one. I'm serving them, door bursts open, and Malcolm comes in carrying a delivery of boxes. And he saw him aghast. He said, Glenn, out the back. I said, what? Who's these guys? I said, they're a band. He said, they're not a band. Now, in fairness to them, they got big coats on. Alex Harvey at the time had sort of National Health Service specs on and stuff. Bear with me for a minute. So he could have been a tax collector, and Chris Glenn and Zal Clemenson could have been his thugs with him, right? And he said, I said, who do you think they are? And he said, they're tax collectors. I said, they're not, they're a band. He said, no, they're tax collectors, get them out. So I said to the guys, I said, look, my mates had a bit of brainstorm. Go and have a pint. It will be gone, and I'll come back and serve it, which is what they did, and I think they went to the robot. A few weeks later, they'd sort of had a hit with Delilah in the meantime. And I took, or I organised, going with my mate Nick Cash from St Martin's Art College, who ended up as the drummer, he's the drummer and the members now and stuff, Bernard Rhodes and Malcolm to see the Alex Harvey Band at Hammersmith Odeon to prove that they weren't tax collectors. Now, dig this, and Malcolm wasn't involved with the band at the time. Steve and Paul were always trying to get him involved, and he kind of humoured us. And while I'm sitting there, he said, how much did it cost to get in? And I said, oh, 75 pence or something like that. He said, well, how many people does it hold? 2,000, 2,500. He went, let's have a meeting about the band in the morning. And that's really what happened.
Wow, that's a great story.
He could sniff the spondulics.
Why do you think this was such a special gig? What was it about this night?
Well, because it was an event. It was, you know, we was playing in a theatre. We knew Roger from before. You know, when he worked and hang out with Malcolm, there was always something going on after work finished on a, for me, work anyway, on a Saturday evening. We didn't finish till 7:30, so you go and have a bite to eat, you have a pint. Oh, what's going on? Oh, there's a movie on the screen on the green. Roger will get us in. He was mates of Malcolm, so we were getting for nothing. And we would see whatever the movies were around at the time, probably somebody mentioned Electra Glide in Blue or something like that. So we was kind of aware of it, and it seemed like a buzzy kind of place. And Malcolm arranged this thing with Roger, and I think Roger kind of wanted something to maybe sort of be involved with Malcolm and Vivian a little bit more, somehow.
But also, what was magic around his night was for a pound. I think it was a pound, wasn't it?
Yeah, pounds again.
The Clash, the Sex Pistols, Clash and Buzzcocks all in one night, you know. Amazing moment, you know, in time of all those bands that went on to do all the things that we've
and
done.
And it wasn't just the bands, because I remember at the end.
Oh, it was the audience as well.
Phil Salon and Susie getting up and.
Oh, yeah, with the Nazi thing doing all that.
All getting up on stage.
Yeah.
No one seems to be able to remember what time they went on. How long? You can't remember when
not
it
really,
was.
Really, yeah.
I know
you at some time in the evening, a bit later on. What I do remember, more than anything else, though, was you mentioned about John chipping his tooth. I think he actually had a cap, and it fell out. And we stopped the set while Susie and the Bromley contingent looked for the cap for his tooth.
I remember that.
And I'm saying to John, get on with it. He said, I'll pay good money for it. I think maybe Susie ended it.
But how amazing, those three bands that night, and then you had the Damned and the Jam. That was in 76, that was the whole punk scene, really.
Yeah.
You know, they were catalysts, the vanguard of a whole lot.
Well, whether you like it or not.
We all wrote the script, I think, all of us, those bands. All the other ones, you know, reenacting the script now, the ones that came later. But that moment in time in 76, you know, going to 77, these, you know, all these phenomenal bands, I don't know what it was in the air or what, you know, how these epoch things happening in time, it's like, fuck, all them great bands, all right at the moment, right here, right now.
And for a long time to come afterwards, because, yeah. You know, I can honestly say, if it wasn't for coming that night, I wouldn't have gone on and had any career in the music business like I did, and I don't think, you know, it certainly reverberated down the years. I think we should see if anyone yes. wants to ask Steve and Glenn some questions. Is that right, guys?
Yes, I think so. I think it's going to. Although I've got one tiny little muso point I wanted to make about the recording of this gig. This is going to be really boring, I'm afraid. When you play Anarchy on the recording of this gig, Steve sounds like he's got a flanger on.
He had a flanger.
He does.
And
yes.
It's like, I mean, I just remember thinking, was that allowed?
Where did Nick go from?
Actually, do you know what happened? Was Steve was a right tea leaf. He was like something out of a Jean Genet book, right? And early on, we went somewhere and we went to see the Flaming Groovies, right? Dingwalls, I think. And there was like me and Steve, the girl from the Slits. Vivian Albertine. Keith Levine, and they had some Mick Jones who had a squat. And so we went back for a drink and a funny cigarette or something like that. We got there, Steve, he's got this brown sort of tan leather attaché case. What you got there? Well, I got it from the gig, didn't I? I said, what do you mean you got it from the gig? Where? From the dressing room, right? So we opened it up. Not only has it got all the Flaming Groovies takings, who were our friends,
wow.
It's got all their tickets and their passports.
Fuck!
And a phase pedal, right? And me and Vivian said, this isn't right. And we found out where they were staying at a hotel, Portman Square Hotel, and we arranged a rendezvous that we would leave it. This is about 4 o'clock in the morning by then. We would leave it behind the third tree on the left while we hid behind the fourth tree on the right and watch them come out and got it. And we gave them it back because of me and Vivian. But Steve said, all right, we can give it back. He said, but I'm keeping a phase pedal. And it was a phase 45, and that's what everybody thought it was a phase 90, but it was a phase 45, and that's what he uses.
If they put that in pistol, they wouldn't have believed it. No.
Yeah, it did sound good, that phase, though, didn't it?
Yeah, it filled cool. The sound
sexy.
Out of it.
Have we got any questions from the house?
Come on, don't be shy.
I got a question. This is what? As I said to you earlier, I love the Rich Kids album. Are there any songs on that album that you think in a different life might have ended up on Never Mind the Bollocks?
A couple, maybe. The single Rich Kids, I mean, not with those words, because John wouldn't have sung that, but the music would have done. And there was a song, Hung on You, which is on the album, which maybe... I started writing right at the tail end of my original tenure with the Pistols.
Right.
You know. But I mean, the thing is, you know, everybody in the band's gone on to do different things of different degrees of success and accomplishment. But I think if somehow we'd kept it together, we could have been pretty darn good, really. But maybe, you know, it had a built-in shelf life just with the nature of the people. And I always see it as like a kind of a two kind of,
well, it's a manager for people
coming together, you know, and they cross and they're not supposed to hit, but we actually hit and there was a big explosion, which was punk, and then the train sort of went off in the different directions.
Anyone else?
What are you up to now, Glenn?
What am I up to now? Well, quite a lot. Yeah, I was played last night at the Andrew Club with my band. I got an album out called Consequences Coming, and I'm also playing with Blondie.
Well, you're both playing that game,
yes.
Aren't you?
Dog Day Afternoon.
Dog Day Afternoon, yeah. So we're playing with Iggy and Blondie, Iggy, Blondie, Generation Sex, which is Steve and Paul and Billy Idol. You're doing it as well, yeah.
I'm doing it as well, yeah.
Yeah, so we've got all the old muckers doing it.
And you've got a colour vinyl of Anarchy coming out, isn't it? Do you know about
that? I don't know about that, probably.
Doesn't know about that.
They're always flogging a dead horse.
Yeah, they are. I saw it.
I don't necessarily
well, actually,
hear
okay,
about
Glenn,
that.
Okay, Glenn, so just let you know, yes, you have.
Okay. What colour? I think this day and age, a coloured one would be black, wouldn't it? They've had all the other colours. That'd be really unusual.
Yellow's intellectual.
Flexi disc, I think, would be the way it goes. Yeah, yeah,
yeah. Thank you, guys.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you.
And listen, I mean, round of applause, please.
Thank you very much.
Glenn and Steve. Wow. That was amazing.
Brilliant.
Amazing.
Thank you.
Do you know, one of the things we always mention is prog, and you know there is a prog connection.
Uh-oh.
prog.
Keith Levine,
yes,
was in the Clash, and he was Alan White's roadie for Yes.
I know. He was proud of it. He told me. And not only that, Lemmy from Motorhead was a roadie for Emerson, Lake and Palmer. And when Keith Emerson used to put a knife to, you know, so pretending he was stabbing the thing, was to hold the key down, and he only kind of did it gently, really, but it looked good. Lemmy had a go of him, and he said, "Don't do that." And he said, "Well, I'm only doing it sort of gently, but the audience don't know that." He said, "No, if you're going to use a knife, use a knife." And he pulled out a Hitler knife bayonet and gave it to him. And that was Lemmy.
We've got to say thank you to all the people who have helped us tonight, right?
All the people who have helped us. Who's helped us?
Gary Crowley.
Yay, DJ. DJ Gary Crowley. Come
we
on.
We love Gary Crowley. Yeah, there he is.
I've known Gary since 1977, 78. Wow.
And Steve Dagger and Steve Woolley for a fantastic
contribution.
Yeah. Contribution.
John Martin for helping with the production. Everybody from Everyman who are have now run this cinema. And
as ever, Ben Jones, our producer.
Gimme Sugar.
Gimme Sugar Productions. And Ian, who's here tonight.
Thank you. So, wow, that wasn't too bad, our first live show. I hope we can do these again. We're going to try and... It's all down to the guests, obviously, and these two have been absolutely amazing.
Yes.
Once more.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
And it's good night from me.
It's good night from them.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.